Welcome to the Far Middle. I am very excited to host episode 83 as always. My name is Nick Deolius. You can follow me on Twitter at Nick Deolius. I'm on LinkedIn. You can peruse my website, nickdeolius.com. And of course, you can buy my book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America, and see what you think. Let me know what you think. We're going to dedicate episode 83 to, of all things, a stork. What say you? That's right, a stork. So more specifically, the Mad Stork, one of the greatest personalities and linebackers in NFL history. His name is Ted Hendricks. He was 6'7" in height, and he wore 83 while roaming the defensive side of the ball through the 1970s and early 80s. Now, the Mad Stork, well, he was not your typical football player. He was born in Guatemala, and when he was recruited by the University of Miami in college, he actually was offered 4 scholarships, one for basketball, one for baseball, one for football, of course, and yes, believe it or not, one for academics. And guess which one he accepted when he attended Miami? He accepted the academic scholarship. He was an honor student in math and physics. He speaks fluent Spanish. As I said, I'm not your typical NFL journey. Now, at Miami, he was a standout on the defensive line side of the ball. Finished 5th in the Heisman voting his senior year back in 1968. He entered the pros with the Colts, who were coached by then the legendary Don Shula. He moved the Mad Stork from the line to linebackers, which is why this noted linebacker has an unusual number for linebackers of 83. His most noted periods were with the Colts and the Raiders. Al Davis, that mercurial Raiders owner, he gave up 2 first-round picks to get Hendricks. John Madden, who was the Hall of Fame coach of the Raiders, wasn't happy with that, and it took him a year to truly integrate Hendricks into the Raiders defense, but boy, did it work out for all, to say the least, including a lot of Super Bowl glory. Hendricks won 4 Super Bowls in all, he's in the Hall of Fame, and he has his own foundation, so he knows how to invest in those around you. So episode 83, it's the first dedication in Far Middle history that goes to a stork. That's the Mad Stork, Ted Hendricks. For those of you who are new to the Far Middle podcast, welcome. It's great having you aboard. And if you're new, what you'll see is that we structure each episode of the Far Middle to connect or make connections to a series of individual issues or dots. And we do this to honor and pay homage to the epic science and history series from the late 1970s and early 1980s, around the same time, by the way, the Mad Stork was storming the football field, which is the TV series Connections. And the host, of course, being Dr. James Burke. Now, Dr. Burke combined history and science in a way that made it really compelling and fascinating to young adults and older adults. Give some of those episodes a viewing on YouTube, or I recommend you purchase a series on DVD or a streaming service. Hey, I've done both. Each episode of Connections would start with a modern innovation at the very beginning, and then it would jump back in time to hundreds of years prior and show how one event or development linked to another, sequentially connecting dots and making connections, hence the name of the series. That ultimately led by the end of the episode to the modern day innovation that was shown at the beginning, so everything tied together. It was truly an innovative format, kept the rapt attention of the viewer throughout the entire episode, and basically that's what we try to do or mimic with each Far Middle episode. I get asked about the format of each episode quite often by new listeners to the Far Middle. People asking, you know, where did you come up with the format and who is this Burke guy and Connections program that you keep mentioning? So it was good to cover those once again and why we structure these episodes the way that we do. And in true Connections fashion, let's start connecting those dots for episode 83. We started talking about Ted Hendricks, and one of his impressive attributes as a player was his durability. At one point, he played in over 200 consecutive games. Now, durability is also quite important when considering what type of car to purchase and drive. The bellwether when it comes to ranking a range of consumer products, including vehicles, is the venerable Consumer Reports magazine. And Consumer Reports recently issued its most recent ranking of vehicles, and it found that electric vehicles were among the least reliable cars and trucks in the automotive industry today. So that finding, you know, certainly got my attention, but what really got me intrigued was when I read on as to the Consumer Reports view on why electric vehicles were not as reliable as hoped for. And the explanation that was proffered by Consumer Reports was that companies that manufacture electric vehicles they didn't have the time to iron out or solve issues that affected or impacted reliability negatively. In other words, you know, just give them more time and all of this will take care of itself and reliability will improve for electric vehicles. With all due respect to Consumer Reports, and I do have longstanding respect for Consumer Reports and its work on behalf of consumers, Consumer Reports is dead wrong as to the root causes of the poor reliability of electric vehicles and the future prognosis for improvement in such. And the reason they're dead wrong goes back to the fundamentals of economics and how efficient markets operate relative to state-controlled markets. Whenever you have the state or government mandating things like electric vehicles and subsidizing electric vehicles and protecting the market share for electric vehicles, it's a certainty that continuous improvement and best in class, they're not going to be embraced and likely will never be achieved. Why is that? Because there's no incentive to do so. Excellence, when you get down to it, it's really tough. Excellence is challenging. Excellence requires excruciating effort. And when you shield industries or products from that Darwinian free market and the consequences of consumer choice, then there's no incentive and no need for automakers to, pun intended, drive toward excellence. So think back to what we've been taught about economies and markets under socialism or communism, right? The food, it's tasteless. The cars, they drive horribly. Fashion is dead. The electricity is unreliable. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And the architecture, it leaves a lot to be desired optically and aesthetically. Unfortunately, America and the EU are sliding quickly from a free market capitalistic economy to a socialist one, or even toward a communist economy, which means in the case of automobiles, when we had a competitive free market, automakers, they were living and dying by product quality and reliability, and consumers were free to choose the better products for the better price. The cars and trucks that did the best in the showroom and with the sales figures, they were the best on the road and with reliability. Those things correlated. But today, what do we have? Under various subsidies and tax credits and government market mandates, the competitive free market has been replaced with a state-controlled rigged market. Sales and volumes of cars are locked in for the automakers as long as they bow to the desires of the bureaucrat, and the automakers are more than willing to bow down. And when you demand that type of behavior, and then the demand for your product is locked in and protected by government, there's no incentive to deliver strong reliability or a great consumer experience. Why bother? There's no incentive to do so, which is why Consumer Reports, they're finding that electric vehicles are among the least reliable cars and trucks in the automotive space today. Passage of time, that's not going to improve the situation. In fact, it's only going to make the poor reliability of electric vehicles more of the norm. And until government allows a return to a competitive free market when it comes to automobiles, don't expect reliability to be anything close to what is desired or to return to what it once was. It's just another illustration of how environmentalism and policies justified under the banner of battling climate change, they're a regression to the inferior. Let's take two taglines you've heard before. One is green is good, and the other one is doing good by doing well. Now, I hear these two things all the time when it comes to products like electric vehicles and the justification for mandating and protecting and subsidizing them. Let's take these pair of taglines, but now put it in the context of green buildings, or specifically LEED certified buildings. And for those of you that don't know or are not familiar with LEED, it stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, or LEED. It's become all the rage in the real estate space these days, particularly for commercial and office space. Recently, I came across an in-depth study by a major real estate firm. It's one that I'm not going to mention specifically here, but you can find the report online. I don't want to mention the firm because I respect the firm. But what this study put forth, frankly, was a bit embarrassing. The title of the report got my attention right away, which was Green is Good, the Enduring Rent Premium of LEED Certified U.S. Office Buildings. Now, as soon as I read that title, it immediately piqued my interest, and I thought to myself, this could be quite interesting. Let's read on. And my hunch was correct. So the executive summary of the report, it starts out by boldly stating that an analysis of 20,000 office buildings in America found that the average rent of those with LEED certification was 31% higher than those of non-LEED certified buildings. Wow, I thought, isn't that impressive, and doesn't that indicate that renovating existing or building new spaces that have high energy efficiencies and meet LEED certification, they're well worth the upfront investment. Well, not exactly. In fact, not at all. As is with the case in many studies, reports, and news articles these days surrounding the energy transition, you need to read the details and pay attention to what's going on between the lines of the executive summary results to assess what's truly going on. Because when you do so for this study of LEED certified buildings, you find that the details of the analysis, they indicate a very, very different result than the headline and executive summary opening statement. Because when one adjusts for the impacts of building location, and remember, when it comes to real estate, it's all about what? Location, location, location. When you adjust for building age, for renovation history, guess what you find? You find that the premium that LEED certified buildings enjoy shrinks from the advertised 31% down to 4% before COVID and only 3% of a premium after COVID. The complete study, you know, to sort of call it as it is, it did a decent job actually of pointing these factors out. It clearly states them in the body of the report, but that's a report body that very few people actually take the time to read. And the conclusion, of course, was that LEED certified office buildings, right, they tend to be larger and higher quality assets that are concentrated in downtowns of expensive cities that are going to enjoy, by a range of different metrics, higher rent premiums than buildings that are smaller and lower quality and maybe not located in the most exclusive of zip codes. An example in the report that sort of proves this out is that a third of Manhattan's office inventory is LEED certified, where for Louisville, the report states that only 1/10 of the office inventory is LEED certified. And of course, rent premiums in Manhattan are going to be much higher than they are in Louisville, and those premiums have very little to do with whether the buildings are LEED certified or not. To the credit of the real estate firm that conducted this study, the authors used regression analysis to adjust an account for the things that we just discussed, building size, renovation history, location, and age. And when they performed the regression analysis, the massive premiums that they advertised of 30%+ in the headline, it shrunk to measly premiums of 3-4%, probably within the statistical uncertainty of the study itself. And what you don't find discussed anywhere in the study, which further destroys its credibility, is recognition of the fact that constructing something that is LEED certified is a much more expensive proposition up front in capital investment than constructing or renovating a non-LEED certified building, which means that when you do an economic analysis under a rate of return or net present value sort of a metric or a screening criteria, building or constructing LEED certified is in many or most cases a losing economic proposition, not a winning one, which of course is the exact opposite conclusion from the study's title, which once again was green is good, the enduring rent premium of LEED certified U.S. office buildings. Now, there are other flaws in the study. For example, it cites the oft-used increased productivity associated with LEED certified buildings when it comes to the workers who inhabit them. That's not always or necessarily true. You know, the debits and credits bookings for accountants working in a LEED certified building don't magically happen quicker or more accurately just because of building certification. There's also the premise that for real estate investors, green buildings offer lower mortgage default risk. I'm not sure that's going to be the case when you look forward into the next 2 years, when you consider that LEED certified buildings are disproportionately concentrated in at-risk bubble markets of places like Manhattan and San Francisco and so on. And further, LEED certified buildings are a favorite of who? The tech industry. And the tech industry right now is on the verge of a major correction with job losses everywhere you look and with office buildings, many of them LEED certified, being vacant or leases being abandoned. You may very well end up seeing higher default rates in LEED certified buildings than traditional ones in the coming years as we go through the grips of a recession or slowdown, or certainly if we end up watching another tech bubble burst. Another little detail in this report that contradicts the report's title is that the regression analysis performed found that office assets built after 2012 commanded a 14% rent premium over those that were built between 2002 and 2011. Each additional decade in age decreased rent by approximately 5%, which means age of the building has a much bigger impact on rent premium than whether a building is LEED certified or not. And there is another issue that has popped up now when it comes to LEED certified buildings in the era of pandemic, and that is the health issues associated with LEED certification. For example, are low flow faucets in restrooms and office buildings that are LEED certified, are they a health risk when it comes to hygiene and germ spread? Think about heating and ventilation systems in LEED certified buildings. They're designed to conserve energy and often recirculate air and recycle air at much higher rates or ratios, and they might use less fresh air makeup than what a non-LEED certified building would use. What are the health impacts of those things when it comes to pandemic and germ spread? The safest and healthiest type of an office building might be the one where water flows are higher in restroom faucets so that germ transfer is minimized, and one where once through systems using things like fresh air for office climate are utilized versus high rates of recirculation or recycle air. And how about all those common areas for collaboration that are promoted in LEED certified buildings? It's been shown that COVID survives on surfaces for days. So common areas, whether they're for eating or meeting or just sitting, they might also pose some health risks in the era of pandemic. Look, constant listeners, I'm not a doctor, and I certainly don't play one on TV. I don't know what the specific answers are to these questions, but I do know that certain aspects that are common in or mandated by LEED certification and LEED certified buildings, they might be items that need a reassessment as to whether they are beneficial or not in the era of COVID. One final detail in this study that I found to be very interesting and that escaped any mention in the executive summary or title was how the regression analysis found that there was no statistically significant rent premium associated with higher levels of LEED certification. So, of course, attaining a higher level of LEED certification requires more investment. And if there's not a statistically significant rent premium associated with higher levels of LEED certification, then being greener is not better. Being greener is bad. You lose money as an office owner by investing to attain a higher level of LEED certification. Greener, in that instance, ends up being a poor investment decision. Interesting. Digging into the details of this real estate study for LEED certification, it truly does warrant more attention. I tend to give it such in the coming weeks. Stay tuned. I might be posting something on nickdeolias.com shortly. And by the way, you know, how I stumbled upon this report was really representative of how the echo chamber works in media when it comes to environmentalism today. I saw a headline on a major business website that mentioned the study's title, Where Green is Good. I read the article from the website and it exclusively highlighted the report's title in that opening statement of the executive summary that showed massive rent premiums for LEED certified buildings. I then tracked down the study that it referenced, and that's where I learned of the regression analysis and how that massive rent premium for LEED certification quickly evaporated once you did the regression analysis and adjusted for building age and location and size and all that stuff. That's how the environmental racket works these days. You perform a study to skew in your direction by applying favorable assumptions. You push your desired findings in the executive summary. You come up with a creative and eye-catching title. You post it or publish it. And then you collaborate with the major media outlets so that they rebroadcast it and further trumpet the desired soundbite or headline. It's not greenwashing. It's actually worse. Most would consider it misleading, unethical, or borderline fraudulent. So far this episode, we've covered issues surrounding electric vehicles and LEED certified buildings. Both of these, of course, manifest from and are driven by climate change alarmism and entities like the United Nations trumpeting that we've got, you know, a code red situation on the planet. Yes, code red justifies the need for mandates in the arenas of electric vehicles and LEED certified buildings, which brings me to the next connection to discuss. And that is that the imperious United Nations a few weeks ago announced that the world population has hit the 8 billion mark. The UN also reported that life expectancy and fertility rates surged to unprecedented levels. Now here's where it gets interesting. First, the UN pointed to the drivers of these improvements in the human condition as being advancements in medicine and nutrition and public health and personal hygiene. And surely all these things helped. But what the UN conveniently failed to mention is perhaps the leading driver for improved fertility rates and life expectancy and growing population is the increased access to reliable and affordable energy, namely energy sources such as natural gas. In other words, it's no coincidence that as human population grows and fertility rates surge and life expectancy increases, at the same time, utilization of natural gas has also increased. As carbon dioxide levels have grown because of increased utilization of energy, it brought with it many good things tied to the human condition. Now, that's blasphemy when you're dealing with zealots in the Church of Climate, but make no mistake, it is an absolute fact and data proven that as CO2 levels increased, so did life expectancies, fertility rates, and educational levels. And you also see this in the specific numbers for life expectancy from 1990 through 2019. So 2019 back through 1990, that's what, almost 30 years, just shy of 30 years. Global life expectancy increased almost 9 years, which is an amazing accomplishment. And it's no coincidence that during the same time, atmospheric carbon dioxide levels also increased. Utilization of things like natural gas improved the human condition, particularly and drastically in the poorer areas of the developing world. What's sadly ironic in all of this is that the United Nations is an institution that's hell-bent on delaying and denying as many souls in the developing world access to reliable and affordable energy in the form of something like natural gas as it possibly can. And it does so, of course, under the banner of Code Red, and that time is running out, and that we're facing climate doom. But to the extent the United Nations efforts are successful in deterring development and utilization and access to natural gas, make no mistake, countless human beings across planet Earth are going to suffer the consequences. It's misery manufactured by bureaucrat, by elite institution, and by the expert class. Sometimes crimes against humanity, they are cloaked in the robes of altruistic niceties. We got time to make one final connection before concluding episode 83. We've been talking about what the United Nations and free markets evolving towards state-controlled markets and how these things, they can stifle quality of life and individual choice in the human spirit. And on top of it, we find ourselves in mid-December. We conclude with an item that wraps all those things together, constant listeners, and that is a speech given in December 1988 at the United Nations by the leader of a communist nation looking to reform itself into something better. The leader was Gorbachev, and that nation was the former Soviet Union. Now, I'm going to read you two short excerpts from that speech, and I ask you to think about irony as you listen to them. And the irony being how Gorbachev was moving his nation toward individual rights and a free market and capitalism and away from communism and state control. Compare and contrast where he was taking his nation to where our leaders are taking America today. Today, we're moving toward the perils that Gorbachev was desperately trying to run away from. Now, he opened with, I think, a very strong set of statements. He said, "Freedom of choice is a universal principle to which there should be no exceptions. We have not come to the conclusion of the immutability of the principle simply through good motives. We've been led to it through impartial analysis of the objective processes of our time." Wow. Think about what he said there. Freedom of choice being a universal principle, and how today more and more freedoms to choose are being removed, whether it be with respect to the consumer, the worker, the thinker, or the scientist. And then there's the reference to objective and impartial analysis and processes. To me, I hear that and it speaks of science and logic and reason, which today are continually subsumed by what? By political science and ideology and irrationality. But Gorbachev, he didn't stop there. He continued. "The process of restructuring is gaining pace. Under the badge of democratization, restructuring has now encompassed politics, the economy, spiritual life, and ideology. We've unfolded a radical economic reform. We have accumulated experience. And from the new year, we are transferring the entire national economy to new forms and work methods." So here, Gorbachev is speaking like a man who's driving society and an economy from the socialist communist bent to one that is free market based and meritocracy based. That's, of course, a process. It's not going to happen overnight in a step change for sure. But listening to those words and contrasting it to America in 2022, you can't help but feel our nation is moving in a 180 degree opposite direction as to where Gorbachev was taking his nation back in 1988, which means we know if we continue on this path where our ultimate destination ends, that's the misery of a state-controlled economy in a socialist or communist society. Hey, capitalism, the free market, individual rights-based rule of law, they're far from perfect. Sometimes the imperfections can be really frustrating. But make no mistake, constant listeners, the American heritage and the foundation of Republican democracy, they lie in the cradle of capitalism. All are easily the superior and best choices for the individual. That was the case in 1776. It was the case during the Industrial Revolution. It was the case during the Cold War. And I assure you, it remains true today. Gorbachev and his speech proved once again, there's a big difference between being a leader and leading. The former is such because they simply hold power, but leading occurs only when a leader inspires, making others want to follow. Food for thought in the coming week when we will talk again. Till then, go out there and lead.